If it may please the court, my name is Mark Keene, and it's my honor to represent Mr. Craig Plackas in this case. I'll answer the first question first, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Judge, I did not try the case, but I have studied the record most carefully.
You sat in here yesterday.
Yes, I did. And I have studied the law even more carefully, Your Honor, and I am going to endeavor to answer all the court's questions. The very first question in this case is whether a CEO of a franchisor may be held liable under the Fair Labor Standards Act as the employer of an independently owned and operated franchisee's employees. That question is answered by looking at the economic reality of the employment relationship. There's four factors there. The power to hire and fire. Who sets the compensation or the method of compensation? Piece rate, hourly, salary. Who sets the schedule? Who sets the conditions of employment? And who maintains the employment records? In this case,
Counsel, Ms. Keene, let me ask you. Do you maintain that the jury was improperly charged?
I do, Your Honor, and I think you raise a very good question. Based on the evidence in this case, how in the world did we get here as the appellant? And the reason we got here is because we had an indecipherable cobweb of jury instructions. As Judge Elrod noted in the Williams versus Hennigan case.
Let's get one detail out of the way. What objections to those charges, to the charge was leveled?
Another very good question, Your Honor. The objection below was not to submit a special verdict on the elements of the economic reality test. However, the error was so plain and so complete that the jury charge has a sufficient basis for reversal under the plain error standard. And the reason for that is that, as Judge Elrod noted in the Williams versus Hennigan case, the statutory definitions of employer, employee, employ are vague.
Time out. All right. Let me make sure I understand the answer to Judge Higginbotham. Are you saying there was an objection to the, quote, improper charge jury vis-a-vis a proper charge, or are you saying there wasn't, but you win anyway under plain error?
Showcase number two, Your Honor. There was not an objection to submitting the statutory definition. There was not an objection to submitting the piecemeal elements of the joint employer test. There was an objection to not submitting the economic reality test by special verdict. The court has wide discretion in that decision. But my point is that when you offer three different definitions of employer, a definition of joint employment, a definition of the elements of the economic reality test, and the jury's not even told that they need to find a one of them, that demonstrates plain error on the jury charge. But our argument, Your Honor, is that we don't even get to that question in this case, because under the evidence that was presented in this case, not one element of the economic reality test was met. And this court has held, Gray versus Powers, Martin versus Spring Break, both in the summary judgment context, and the summary judgment standard mirrors the JMOL standard.
So your argument is ultimately that, no reasonable juror could, on this record, conclude that there was this employee-employer relationship.
Absolutely, Your Honor. But
let's focus on the evidence then, that it comes down to that.
And it always does, Your Honor.
Yes.
The plaintiff testified in this case, who hired you? This CEO of the franchisee, Ms. Encher. Isn't it true that Mr. Plackas didn't hire you? Correct. Who set your pay? The franchisee CEO. Isn't it true that Mr. Plackas didn't do that? Who set the manner in which you were going to be paid? Franchisee, not franchisor.
Go down about 2 decibels.
Okay, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I get excited. Who set your schedule in this case? The franchisee, not the franchisor. Who made changes to your pay? Franchisee, not franchisor. Who maintained your employment records? Franchisee, not franchisor. Not testimony from Mr. Plackas, testimony from the plaintiff himself. Not subjective beliefs or opinions, facts. Who hired you? Who paid you? Who set your schedule? Unequivocal, clear, uncontradicted testimony from a witness the jury was not free.
What's your evidence? I thought there was evidence that the franchisee effectively terminated employees at the direction of the franchisor.
That's a completely inaccurate statement, Your Honor. We do see that statement.
Well, I don't know if it's accurate or not, but could the jurors here have concluded from the other testimony about the relationship between the franchisee and the franchisor that in operation they were effectively controlling who would continue as the employee and who would not be?
We would suggest to Your Honor that no, and that it's not even a close question.
Is there evidence in the record that that happened?
Absolutely not. There is not a single occasion where the franchisor directed the franchisee to terminate anybody, hire anybody, anything of that nature. Therefore, a inference in that regard is unsupported speculation, and a jury is not permitted to engage in unsupported speculation. The franchisor never directed the hiring practices. And how do we know this? Because Mr. Orozco was not the only witness at trial. Ms. Encher, the CEO of the franchisee, testified. All the hiring decisions. Not some of them. All of them. Mr. Palakis had nothing to do with my business. Not something to do with my business. Nothing to do with my business. Uncontroverted testimony from the franchisee's CEO. Buttress that evidence with the franchise agreement, which reposes ultimate control and responsibility into the franchisee. Now, I've come from Texas, Your Honor, to be fair and honest about the record, and I do want to make a concession. The franchise agreement's not controlling if it doesn't comport with economic reality. If the franchise agreement said the franchisee's in control, but the facts didn't comport with that, the franchise agreement wouldn't control. But the franchise agreement's terms exactly mirror the franchisee CEO Ms. Encher's testimony and exactly mirror the plaintiff's testimony, and it reposes day-to-day control. That's the wealth of the evidence in the case.
We as the Court of Appeals should be very reluctant to second-guess juries. I mean, that shouldn't be our business. But it's your position that we don't need to second-guess this jury because all the facts establish as a matter of law that there's no, and that the motion for judgment as a matter of law should have been granted. Is that your position?
That is our position, Your Honor, and it's a twofold position. One, employer status under the FLSA is a question of law. Number two, the jury is given great deference, not on questions of law. Those are reviewed de novo here. They're given great deference on factual findings. I have pored over that record. I have pored over that jury charge. There's not a single factual finding in that record. The jury didn't make any. We asked for it. We asked that the jury make those specific factual findings, and we were not successful in that effort, Your Honor. Therefore, there are no specific factual findings to which great deference is given, and even if there were, that can be reversed when the substantial and overwhelming weight of the evidence in the case demonstrates otherwise.
This was a consent trial before the magistrate judge?
It was, Your Honor. It was a consent trial before Judge Magistrate Lane.
I'm confused about the magistrate judge's ruling in the motion for judgment of a matter of law, where all the testimony of the plaintiff is disregarded. Is there precedent for that in this circuit?
Your Honor, not only confused, I'm stunned and perplexed by that. There is no precedent for ignoring the plaintiff's testimony. This very court, in Gray versus Powers, accepted the deposition testimony of the plaintiff that he considered another, the general manager, to be his employer because he hired him and he directed him. And
if that had been on summary judgment at a depo, we would have affirmed that.
I believe so. I believe that this case is controlled by Gray versus Powers and Martin versus Spring Break, not the facts. As Judge Higginbotham indicated in another question and another case on JMOL standards, facts are infinitely variable. It is the principles from the cases which control. And the principle in this case is if there is no evidence on a single element of the economic reality test, a reasonable jury could not find for the plaintiff.
What if we find there's one? What if we find one's met? Is that good enough?
It is not good enough. Gray versus Powers had one. Mr. Powers had hired the general manager. He had investment in the company, and the court said that that wasn't enough. I think Martin versus Spring Break is actually even more on point. Callahan and Martin had actually hired and fired people. The plaintiff put his deposition testimony in front and said that declaration, excuse me, that he had actually witnessed Callahan hire and fire.
This is two enough, perhaps?
It's not a matter of scorekeeping, Your Honor. It's a matter of the entire relationship.
But one is definitely not enough under our precedent.
Zero is definitely not enough. By your precedent, one is not enough, Your Honor.
So you say you should have won the case at the conclusion of the plaintiff's case.
But we believe that that's the proper disposition of the case at the trial court level. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here, Your Honor.
I'm saying that's what your argument is, that you should have won the case at the conclusion of the plaintiff's case.
The trial judge should have granted the JMOL. But of course, that matter, this court is not bound and hinged by those determinations. That matter is reviewed de novo on appeal.
Well, in Gray, you know, it was the bartender. You know, here we've got, you know, the employee. I mean, is the concession of the employee or the testimony of the bartender, I mean, is it dispositive or is it but one factor, assuming there are facts that the jury can consider and all that?
It is just but one factor. That is why Ms. Encher's testimony is important. That is why the franchise agreement is important. That's why our brief says just because the plaintiff confessed to the truth at trial, that Mr. Plakas held no dominion over any aspect of his employment, the case isn't over there. There's more evidence to be had. The rest of the evidence comports with his testimony. Ms. Encher's testimony says he doesn't have anything to do with my employees. And the franchise agreement, likewise, is supportive of that. And there's no evidence to the contrary.
What was the Mr. Plakas' argument to the jury? I'm taking it it's the same that you're making?
I couldn't say that, Your Honor. I actually did not review.
I didn't mean identical. I mean, you know, as far as the legal position.
I believe so. Attempting to.
In other words, that there was no evidence. I'm just trying to. I know it's not evidence. I just always like to have a feel for how the case was tried.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just trying to get the essence that, okay, the evidence has come in, didn't win on the JMOL, but, you know, you didn't get a special verdict form, so now this case is going to the jury. So I'm just trying to get the feel for what was the argument, you know, to the jury that the plaintiffs conceded, you know, no elements, B, the franchise agreement, I mean, just what was it?
Those two points, Your Honor, is that Mr. Plakas was not his employer. Ms. Encher came in, testified as a disinterested witness that she was his employer and that she handled the employees and that he shouldn't be liable. That's basically the thrust. Trying to distill those factual arguments into legal points.
So where did the case, not asking you to jump in 12 people's minds, but you're obviously skilled, you've been around the block a few times. So where did the case get off with the jury? You're surely not arguing that the presence or absence of a special verdict form was the linchpin, I don't think you are. So where did it go off for the jury here, given, you know, what you've said? I mean,
in all candor, Your Honor, I don't know. I don't know how the jury reached this conclusion based on this evidence.
I mean, frequently we get cases that, while we don't flip them, the jury charge is, you know, the vehicle that sends the jury, you know, down a trail or whatever. And so we look there first. In others, it may be some expert witnesses that they're attached to. And it's not dispositive to get into the jury's mind. It's just we got a fully tried case, same arguments made.
Let me take back the I don't know, Your Honor. It must be the verdict form. Without clear guidance to the jury, they can't make a considered decision. And in this case, they were not given any guidance of who's the employer. The employer is somebody who employs people. That's not a helpful definition to the jury.
Did the plaintiff testify that Sandra, the franchisee manager or owner, whatever, met with the franchisor, Mr. Plakas, and shortly and on his recommendation, quote, she then made substantial changes in his own working hours and compensation?
I'm most pleased that you asked the question, Your Honor. The testimony in the case uncontradicted that Mr. Plackis was asked by the franchisee to give advice. He gave advice. What she did with
give
it...
Give advice about the management, yes, but what the advice that was given, quote, advice was given, which was immediately followed, was to change the working conditions and the hours and compensation of the employee. Now, my question is, could a reasonable juror say the sequencing of that demonstrates the practical control that's being exhibited? He also suggested that they put in this expensive equipment, a radio or whatever, and they did that. In other words, all of his suggestions were promptly instituted.
And I see my time. May I respond to the question, Your Honor?
Yes. I'm not taking a position on that. I'm just saying I want you to respond to those particular arguments. Yes.
It's the difference between communication and the fist of compulsion. The franchisor communicated with the franchisee in regard to their inquiry. She was free to accept or reject. Two cases answer that question. Dunlop versus Ashe from this case, from this court, which says the mere provision of advice is not demonstrative of control, and actually more watered down question in the enterprise context, coverage of control. And I stand before Your Honor having made a tactical or an error, an oversight. In our papers, we did not include the In Re Enterprise case, but we have included it in our Rule 28J letter that we filed on Sunday. That case is extremely important. There, the parent company made all kinds of recommendations to the subsidiary, including a recommendation on the very FLSA violation at issue. The parent told the subsidiary, "We recommend that you do not pay your assistant branch managers overtime." And the court in that case, affirming summary judgment, said that no reasonable jury could find otherwise.
All right, Mr. King, you've reserved rebuttal time to come back up later. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll now hear from Mr. Johnson.
May it please the court, Aaron Johnson from the Equal Justice Center on behalf of Benjamin Orozco. The jury in this case heard 2 days' worth of testimony to the effect that the way Mr. Craig Plackis ran the Craig O's Pizzeria chain was not like a typical franchise, and that he exerted significant operational control over the work situation there. And Mr. Plackis is asking the court blatantly to reweigh the evidence that the jury heard. And
what's the direct testimony that goes to the question of control? A franchisor has, by the very structure of franchisor and franchisees, has inherent in the necessity of maintaining its mark and its brand to exercise control. So we start with that. Where in this record is there evidence which a juror can conclude that this moves from what were expressed in precatory language is really an exercise of control? And the context matters, and that's why I want to frame it that way. The general office I worked for many years ago made suggestions to this young captain. I followed them. Because I knew the control of the system. Now, the question here is what's in that, that from which the juror can make that kind of conclusion that that's really what's going on here was control?
I absolutely agree, Your Honor, and I understand that reference. In fact, I used the reference of, my experience in the Army as well and how my officers controlled, but it's the context, and we're looking at the franchise context here, Your Honor. And it's clear that franchisors necessarily and typically exercise control over certain matters. If you look at Section 203R of the statute,
But go back to the question is directing you to the evidence. So I'm taking about the question of where is the evidence?
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. I'm going to get straight to the evidence.
Order that first, then you can come back to the statutory framework.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Let me point to several examples in the record of evidence that goes beyond the typical kind of control that franchisors exercise and goes directly to controlling the work situation. First of all, to understand the context of this case, the jury heard that when Ms. Entier approached Mr. Plackis about opening a franchise. This was very early in the history of the Crego's pizzeria chain. He had only 2 years earlier, in 2003, opened his first location. So he had just gotten it off the ground, just opened his second location, which he owned and operated. He didn't have any experience or any system in place to train a franchisee and then send them off, cede operational control over that to them. Ms. Entier came in, and he says he initially didn't want to set it up as a franchise. She asked him to do it. He agreed. She had no restaurant industry experience. Mr. Orozco, who was her main employee, had no restaurant experience. So Mr. Plackis trained them and set them up, trained them in his own location. She went off to work. What Mr. Plackis did is he stayed in the restaurant regularly, in person, in their training and supervising the work.
But when the reason I want to buy a franchise is because I want that brand and I want that advice. I want that business method. I'm buying a business model. I'm paying for that help and instruction.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And one of my concerns is that if we're too loose, if we're too relaxed, too quick to infer this kinds of controls, we're really striking out at a very powerful business model in this country.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think that's why it's very important that this case is nothing like the typical franchise. This is not McDonald's. It's not KFC. What we have here is Mr. Craig Plackis, the namesake and founder of this restaurant, going with his very first franchisee and working. He would come in regularly to the restaurant, the record shows, sometimes twice a week, other times twice a month. He would jump behind the counter side by side with the employees, taking orders, serving customers, showing them how to do the work. He would, when he was there in the store, he would talk to the other hourly paid employees directly, give them instructions. They would convey those instructions. Those who were bilingual would convey the instructions to Orozco, who only spoke Spanish. He would meet with Ms. Entier for half an hour at a time on these visits. And he would discuss things with her, not just about the brand, how to cook the pizzas, how to maintain the secret sauce, how to maintain the consistent customer service and that sort of thing. But he testified he would evaluate employees' performance with Ms. Entier, and he testified that it was his role there with her not just to protect his brand and his recipes and that sort of thing, but to instruct her on virtually all aspects of business administration, including the very heart of this case, how to minimize labor costs. And he testified that he trained his franchisees on an ongoing basis how to minimize labor costs.
So does Burger King. Well, but that doesn't make them responsible. That's a very common thing, that you have seminars with your managers and franchisees about how to minimize labor costs and things. I guess what is the evidence that Plackis possessed the power to hire and fire the employees?
With regard to hire and fire, Your Honor, if I can respond first to the first question, Your Honor, the difference between Burger King there is he wasn't just giving sort of general advice about trying to control labor costs. He gave very specific advice. He came in and reviewed her payroll records and her schedules, testified he knew that Mr. Orozco was working nearly 80 hours a week and not getting paid overtime, and he made a specific recommendation to say, hey, you know what, since he's doing that, let's cut this hourly paid dishwasher and give his duties to Orozco so we can cut your labor costs further. And the context of that meeting was because the business was failing. He was coming in, and he testified at that time that he had the right to terminate the franchise agreement. But he decided not to because he wanted to try to help revive the profits and restore his royalties. He hadn't been getting royalties for over a year. So he testified.
So you believe that the testimony that he gave consulting advice about this specific employee and the fact that the specific employee's job was changed after he gave consulting advice shows that Plackis actually had the power to hire and fire the employee. Is that the answer to the question?
No, that's not. That was the answer to your question about how is that different from Burger King, McDonald's.
Okay.
With regard to hiring and firing, there is no evidence that he directly said that he had the power to hire or fire a roast.
There's opposite evidence in the record.
There is some opposite evidence, Your Honor. However, what the factor there that's relevant is whether he has the power to hire and fire employees in that workplace. And, in fact, he did initially hire many of the San Marcos employees.
For his own shop, not for that shop.
Correct, Your Honor. But thereafter, he maintained an arrangement to share those employees with Ms. Entier. And they had several employees this way. And to demonstrate the purpose of that sharing arrangement, for example, two of those shared employees were brothers, Rogelio and Pastor Hernandez. And what they did is they had crisscross schedules. And what I mean by that is that Rogelio would be working mornings at Mr. Placas's store while Pastor worked mornings at Ms. Entier's store. In the afternoon, they would swap places. They would make the 30, 40-minute drive between Austin and San Marcos to swap shifts. And clearly, the only logical reason for doing that is to avoid the overtime requirements of the Act.
And are you saying that each company chooses to just like people under the ACA hire people for less than 30 hours, and so then they have to work at the Burger King and the McDonald's for their week? I mean, I don't understand how that shows that he had control power to hire and fire the employees.
Well, Your Honor, with regard to hiring and firing, the testimony from Ms. Entier was that if one of these employees already worked for Mr. Placas and they were available to work for her, she didn't need to train them. She would just hire them
because automatically. They were trained already. Because Mr. Placas had invested. She hired an experienced person.
Correct, Your Honor.
So where does it show that Placas possessed power to hire and fire?
So I think you can draw the reasonable inference there that with regard to those employees, Mr. Placas effectively hired them. With regard
hired
to
them
firing.
At his own shop, and then she hired them at her shop.
Yes, Your Honor. I think there's also reasonable inference that he arranged to have them work at her shop also, remembering that she didn't have anybody.
Where is that reasonable inference that he arranged? He said, ma'am, you need to hire these people to work at your shop.
Well, one of the things, Your Honor, is that since she had no experience at all in this industry, neither did Mr. Orozco at the outset, it was two of his main employees who went to work for her and brought that experience initially. The jury, I think, could reasonably infer that he helped arrange that. Also, with regard to firing, Your Honor, Mr. Placas testified verbatim quote at the with regard to this meeting that took place in January of 2010, he says, I analyzed where to cut people on a shift-to-shift basis, and after the meeting, quote, we cut positions. And I think the jury could infer from that he has the power to at least share in the control with her to cut people's positions.
And that was in regard not to his restaurant, but regard to her restaurant that he told her and she took and that she took his suggestion not as a consultant but as a control. That's in the record.
Well, he certainly characterizes it mere advice or guidance, Your Honor.
Okay.
However,
what about we got to get to the other elements. Placas has determined the rate and method of payment. Is that in the record, or do you concede that that's not there?
Oh, that's certainly, I think that he was exercising power over that. He was sharing in the control over that with these decisions over schedules and looking at analyzing Mr. Orozco's illegal flat salary and how to use
maintain
that to cut
employment
costs further.
Records. Do you concede that's not present?
He did not maintain the records,
okay.
Your Honor. Just
But you think you've met three of the four factors? Is that what you believe, or how many do you believe you've met?
Yes, Your Honor. I think there was the power to hire and fire, and most importantly, to supervise the schedules and working conditions of the employees.
And they also rate and method of payment. You made
yes,
that
Your
one,
Honor.
Too.
I think that was demonstrated, Your Honor. I think that was at least the reasonable inference that the jury could
What draw. About the contrary testimony of the plaintiff, which we still haven't talked about? Your plaintiff negated every single element.
Sir?
That would have been summary judgmentable.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because he didn't really negate each of those elements. First of all, that snippet of testimony wasn't the only testimony that the jury heard in the record. They heard a whole body of other evidence to the contrary. And this court has held in Mr. W. Fireworks and Usry Pilgrim Equipment in those cases that even though the plaintiff's testimony was uncontradicted about the facts that they thought made them an independent contractor, that didn't control and that didn't override the conflicting evidence.
If there is conflicting evidence. So if we don't agree that there's conflicting evidence, then we're done, right?
If you agree if you believe there's no conflicting evidence, of course that would be the case, Your Honor.
Okay. Do you think the magistrate judge erred as a matter of law in determining that his testimony should be disregarded because of his job level or his sophistication? Is that an error as a matter of law?
No, Your Honor, and I don't think he found that it had to be disregarded. I think he found that the jury could reasonably look at the conflicting evidence and draw the conclusion that he didn't have any actual knowledge that Mr. Plackus had no control, no effective control over any of these factors.
We have in this circuit allowed that testimony to be sufficient in plea pool where who did not have sophisticated backgrounds, haven't we?
Your Honor, if we're talking specifically about the Gray versus Powers case, I think in that case there was testimony about what Mr. Powers didn't do, and there wasn't any conflicting evidence to the contrary. The plaintiff there was trying to rely simply on his status as a member of an LLC, and that's what was controlling, the court said, was not enough. You have to show how he was actually involved in operational control over employment matters, which we have abundant evidence of in this case.
All right, Mr. Johnson, you have the red light. Thank you.
Thank you for your attention.
All right, Mr. Edenfield.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Paul Edenfield, and I represent the Secretary of Labor as amicus curiae in support of Mr. Orozco. I'd like to proceed directly to a comment made by Judge Higginbotham concerning context. I think it is absolutely the case that context matters in determining whether or not an individual is an employer under the Fair Labor Standards Act. It's well recognized.
Let me ask
yes, Your Honor.
A quick question factually, and try to put this in context. Part of the difficulty in this case with a franchise, these controlled enterprise in these situations, and the franchisor, the franchisor, is that they really are financially in bed together. They have a common interest in making money and getting the product and the franchisor and in protecting his brand, its brand. So you start from that. And I don't think the Department of Labor wants to infer rules, create rules that are going to pass that liability back to a franchisor. There's testimony that the franchisor, Mr. Blackness, came in and said, you need to get rid of some, you got dishwashers here. For whatever reason, you want to get rid of dishwashers. It costs money. You can do somebody, there's a better way to do this, and so forth. And they say, okay. And so now is that control over the hiring and firing in this context? Or it looks to me like that he's making a recommendation as to the how do you maximize your profits is a better way to do that. Now, yes, it is. That's my question. And how do we, if we conclude that it's up to lead to a jury to determine that is control and creates liability, then I'm not sure where we are from a policy standpoint. That's what you're
sure. For. Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. The Secretary certainly believes that the mere existence of a franchise relationship does not itself indicate employer status, of course, and that each case is fact intensive. With respect to the four-factor test, I think the Gray decision made clear that it's not scorekeeping. I think you have to look at what factors of the four are met in the context of the overall case. There certainly is precedent. I think Sabine Irrigation and or Grimm Hotel sort of go to the point that when someone actually exercises control with respect to what's at the heart of an FLSA violation, and by that I mean sort of wage and hour violations, that's sort of a high watermark in terms of what might constitute the kind of control that would warrant liability under the Fair Labor Standards Act. I would also note, sort of with respect to Judge Elrod's point about sort of Burger King franchises, there are certainly franchises arrangements that involve training. I think the National Restaurant Association's amicus brief goes into the fact that franchise agreements will frequently sort of set forth procedures and manuals, things of that nature.
And they'll come in and observe, and they'll work side by side.
Right.
I mean, I
think that's right, Your Honor. I think looking at this case through the prism of
perhaps I'm the only one in this room with the fast food experience of some extent, but.
And Judge Elrod, I understand.
So what is the Secretary's interest? If as long as the four-part test is applied, I'm trying to figure out what the Secretary's interest. As long as we agree on what the test is, what's your interest?
I think that fair question. Thank you, Your Honor. I think that the Secretary's interest is twofold. Number one, there's a dearth of precedent on the question of franchise relationships. And certainly the National Restaurant Association's amicus brief, and I believe Mr. Plackus' brief suggests that there should be some sort of rule as concerns franchise relationships. We strongly believe that it's consistent with the long history in which this circuit has interpreted the Fair Labor Standard Act's employer standard, that you know there's no sort of formal barriers.
What's the evidence here in the view of the government that moves over to the from a relationship that's inherent in franchise or franchisee crosses the line and gives impermissible control or liability control, if you will, effectively. In this case, what are the facts here that do that?
Sure. Judge Higginbotham, I would say to that question that there, again, looking at this through the prism of a jury verdict, number one, there is the franchise agreement itself, which actually uniquely conveys specific authority with respect to personnel matters. I don't claim that that's the be-all and end-all of control, but it's a relevant backdrop.
The agreement itself doesn't do it.
Right, but it's exactly, Your Honor. But it's a relevant backdrop from which a jury can make certain. Sure.
Where in that record do we point to?
I would look, number one, sort of significant email traffic between Mr. Plakas and Ms. Ensger over the period of their franchise relationship, where he's consistently stating, not in terms of recommendation, but consistently conveying mandatory instructions as to various aspects of the business. For example, stating, you need to respond to this customer complaint. You need to set forth workplace safety checklists for your kitchen. Things of that nature that suggest that his hands were very much in the day-to-day operations of his franchisee.
You need to respond to customer complaints is something that
it's a question of
control.
I think looking at that, Your Honor, but also in tandem with his regular
visits. Well, let's break it down a little more.
Sure.
Instruct. You need to, the franchisor says you need to respond to customer complaint.
Sure.
That's one. Now, what's the next one?
Sure. I would say he commanded the franchisee to implement a kitchen safety checklist that would require that each kitchen employee go through certain requirements to make sure that the kitchen environment was safe. There is his, and again, I
sure there's tomato on the pizza.
I guess what I say this, Your Honor, not to sort of say any specific one of these factors is enough, but to say if you look at the totality of these emails, and then in particular if you turn to, as you noted before, the meeting between Mr. Plakas and Ms. Ensger, at which he recommended or he stated his indication that you should cut kitchen staff, and after that point there was an immediate move by Ms. Ensger to cut a dishwasher, which in turn led to Mr. Orozco's hours going up. If you look at that in the context of consistent emails issuing instructions, regular visits to the store, a franchise agreement that conveys on its face broad authority to the franchisor.
What's the franchisor to do then? Just watch the thing go down the tube?
I think that traditionally there are mechanisms in the relationship. The franchisor can typically terminate a relationship.
Well, what should they have done that would have been permissible?
I think, for example, if you look at sort of a Burger King franchise, I don't think, Your Honor, you see sort of Burger King franchise going out there and getting involved, getting their hands in individual stores. I think they would exercise other mechanisms. They would use, again, their right to leverage the ability to withdraw the franchise arrangement entirely as a means to get what they want from the franchisee. You don't see sort of this kind
this
of operation.
This is what Mr. Plakas has tried to do. He said he might do that.
I think that's right. I think at the end of the day that is something.
And that's reasonable. You're not saying that was nefarious.
I'm not suggesting that, Your Honor.
Are you saying that our precedent in Dunlop v. Ashley, which says the provision of advice does not equate to control unless the decision transfers from the to the franchisor? You're not saying that precedent is not the way the secretary wants the policy.
I think, Your Honor, what I would say with respect to that is there's an inference that the jury could have made in this case that this went beyond
their
advice.
Which baffles me, again, the secretary's interest. If it's just a matter of the application of the settled law of this circuit, which you say is right to the facts of this case, what is your interest?
Sure. Judge Elver, may I answer? I see my red light is on. Sure. So I think, as I said, I think that there is a legal principle embedded in this by which the court could address the question of franchises as a more general matter. And I think that's part one. Number two, I think the Secretary recognizes that facts, in terms of the employer status discussion, facts matter. Facts fill out the law. And looking at these facts, again, through the prism of a jury verdict, I think the Secretary felt it was important to weigh in to state his views as to the fact that The facts in this case and the record before the jury do establish employer status.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Edwards.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Back to you, Mr. King.
Thank you, Your Honor. In regard to some of the inquiries, we're not speculating. We don't need to speculate how franchises work. Another oversight, my responsibility, was the lack of a substantial treatment to the franchisor cases in the brief. They're identified in a string cite in the enterprise section. That is, and parenthetical explanations, that was far too modest a treatment for those cases. Let's talk about 7-Eleven, Chick-fil-A, Domino's Pizza, and we've already talked about Enterprise. We got three cases directly on all fours regarding a franchise or a franchisee relationship. In Singh versus 7-Eleven, they shared...
Well, let me just cut you off. I mean, it doesn't seem there's any argument about which cases are out there. I mean, we've all read Dunlop, and we've read Gray, and we'll read Enterprise, and we'll read the rest. It equally seems to me everybody agrees the facts in all these cases are different, albeit a bartender, et cetera. So I come back to where I was. The default position is when we have a jury verdict, you know, there's deference to the jury verdict, and we're sort of chary to upset a jury verdict. It happens. That's why we're here. So we're in a proposition of, is this a fact-sensitive case to where there are facts that a jury could reasonably find that support the verdict? If there's not, you know, that's why we get employed. We flip it. We say, as a matter of law, no rational jury could be here. So it just doesn't seem to me, we don't read all the cases. The legal principles don't seem to be at issue. The secretary hadn't posed some legal issue. So that's why I started and asking you, okay, where do you say the jury got off? Was it the charges? And you said to me, it really was, and that's where you think it got derailed, at least beyond the judge should have granted the JMOL. So aren't we in a fact tussle of where your side says there are no facts from which a reasonable jury could infer? Doesn't that lead back to where you were?
That is our position, Your Honor, and the reason these franchise or franchisee cases are so important is it places into context the fact. For instance, the franchisor's right to terminate the relationship found not to be sufficient to evidence control. All the franchisor franchisee cases, it's not control floating up in the air. It's not control about a radio. It's not control about making sure floors are clean. It's control on the specific elements of the FLSA violation, wages.
Is there control in the specific elements of the FLSA evidenced in the emails? And if so, then do we have to defer to the verdict?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. These emails are, we're going to go from 3-1 to 1-1 couponing. We're going to think about staying open an extra hour in the summer. It's a good way to maximize sales and profits. Singh versus 7-Eleven. It's okay for the franchisor to discuss with the franchisee options to maximize profits. Make sure the store is clean and there's not more than two dirty tables at a time. You go to McDonald's, it's welcome to McDonald's. May I take your order, please? Everywhere. Not what do you want at some place and a kind greeting at other places.
So are you telling us, if we look at this record really thoroughly to the extent we haven't already done so, that we are not going to find something that says this gentleman was pushing her, that he was showing control through their factual interactions in these emails?
Yes, you will not find that, Your Honor. You will find the usual and typical communications between a franchisor and a franchisee ensuring uniformity of product, uniformity of customer experience. And in fact, not one of the emails is articulated in a you must. It's you should. Think about. That's the manner in which these emails are communicated, are discussed. And the subject matter of the email are typical features of the franchise relationship. It's not hours. It's not pay. It's not compensation. It's not schedules. It's not, and this court's authority, both in Gray versus Power, Martin versus Spring Break, and all the other cases that we've cited, these franchisor-franchisee relationships, say the power must be substantial. Doesn't have to be continuous, but it must be substantial, and it must relate directly to the FLSA issues in the case.
Timing issue, does that create a fact issue alone on the control?
The advice?
The timing of the advice and then the decision that was made. The jury infer from that enough?
It could not, Your Honor, not when Ms. Encher testified that it was advice only. She was free to do with it what she wanted, and she made all the decisions. In fact, the In Re Enterprise case indicates that that advice alone, recommendations alone, is not demonstrative of control.
She disbelieved that it was advice alone, considering she acted so quickly.
She could not. The jury was not free to disbelieve the uncontradicted testimony of a disinterested witness. She testified that it was advice alone. Mr. Plakas testified that it was advice alone. Throw his testimony out. They're not required to believe that, but they are not permitted to speculate and rest their decision on speculation in contravention of the avalanche of testimony to the contrary, Your Honor. I see that my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Keene.
Thank you for having us, Your Honor.
Ed and Phil, very interesting case, to say the least. We appreciate the briefing and oral argument. The case will be submitted along with the other cases that have been argued, and we'll decide it. With that, this panel stands in recess until 9 a.m. in the morning.